I don't see a world that's getting worse. I see a world that, for the most part, is getting better, with some very specific problems that still need to be resolved, and some that I think will blow up the whole system. Like, if we lose our ability to govern one another, and we lose our ability to cooperate at a sufficiently high scale, then all of this is over. Like, we're not going to talk about... Forget international cooperation. We're not going to have national cooperation. That, to me, is the existential threat. It's not like what... It's not what the environmentalists are deeply concerned about. We've passed those thresholds.
Michael, what is this grand theory of everyone?
So I'll tell you. So I wrote this book because one of the biggest open questions is, why are humans so different to other animals, right? Like, we're clearly an animal. We look a lot like our closest cousins, chimpanzees, but we're also very different. I mean, we're building rockets, we're flying to the moon, we're building the internet, we're talking across, you know, continents. How did that happen? Why did it happen? A theory of everyone describes this kind of advancement that we made in understanding the selection pressures that led to our species, that has all kinds of implications for everything that humans do. So in that sense, it's a kind of grand, unifying, overarching theory. And that key breakthrough was that we are just like other animals in that we are the products of genetic evolution. But we went down a different lineage that no other animal seems to have gone down. And that is a reliance on socially transmitted, what I sometimes call cultural software, which is also an evolving system. So humans did something very interesting and very different to other animals. That is, we went beyond what was in our genes and what we could learn over our lifetime to kind of have a system that could absorb beliefs and behaviors and technologies and entirely new skill sets, like the ability to reason, the ability to read, the ability to count, entire new skill sets that we didn't possess previously that are kind of invented culturally and then transmitted. So there are very important insights, and they're very important changes in how we understand what it is that we built based on that theory. So it's called cultural evolution or dual inheritance theory. But the basic idea is that humans are the product of millions of years of genetic evolution, thousands of years of cultural evolution, which is different across the world to the point where we almost speciated not along genetic lines, but along cultural lines, as well as a kind of short lifetime of experience where we fine-tune that model, if you like, that we absorb from our societies. That's as quick as I can do it without getting into the details, Levon.
Okay. What about these four laws of life that you talk about in the book? Can you kind of take us through how they kind of complement one another? You have energy, innovation, cooperation, and evolution.
Yeah, so in explaining, why humans are so different, there's a few key puzzles about us that need to be explained. One of them is obviously our ability to innovate, right? So we invent stuff that other animals simply don't. But that actually goes hand in hand with another massive human capacity, which is the ability to cooperate with one another at a scale that's almost like ants or bees. You know, we're almost eusocial. We almost operate as a collective. And in fact, you know, part of that theory of everyone is that a lot of the innovation activity isn't happening in the individual brain. It's not that, you know, we have Sir Isaac Newton and, you know, we have Einstein and we have these key figures. It's that we've kind of distributed the cognition and ideas are flowing through the social network and recombining in the heads of specific people like Einstein, Alvin Newman or any of these. And of course, we do differ in our abilities, but it's not kind of pure hardware that's driving these processes. So to explain, you know, all of these interlinked pieces, I lay out kind of four laws. They're not like Newtonian laws. They're more like lenses with which you can view the world and offering you kind of levers. And they are energy. So one of the things that have allowed for the vast amount of innovation that we have created, as well as our ability to cooperate at much higher scales, is our control over large amounts of energy. And there have been key moments in human history where we have unlocked new energy capacities that have then enabled new human capabilities. So the first of those was fire, right? So what is fire? It's really kind of a pre-digestion of calories outside the body that allowed us physiologically to kind of shrink our guts, shrink our jaws. So we're not got gorillas kind of sitting there chewing all day or like cows having to digest for a long time. We pre-digested with fire. And that allowed us to vastly expand the amount of energy that our species had access to, which we then put into larger brains, which are incredibly calorie expensive. So if you don't know, brain tissue is about 20 times as calorie expensive as muscle tissue. It uses about the same amount as the rest of your body, actually. So energy was this major ceiling. So the first was fire. The next major revolution was probably the agricultural revolution. So we hit a limit. We were in this kind of Malthusian world of, you know, tooth and claw, where we're really hunter-gatherers having to fight with the elements. And then we figured out, probably accidentally at first, that when we dropped stuff on the ground, it would occasionally grow into stuff, and we could do it deliberately. And so the agricultural revolution takes off. What we have is a kind of solar technology. We're using the power of the sun through photosynthesis to vastly create far more calories than we previously had access to, which then allowed us to vastly increase our population sizes. And the previous way of living, the hunter-gatherer way of living, gets replaced in this evolutionary process. It gets pushed to the margins where hunter-gatherers still live today. So they live in deserts, they live in, you know, forests that are hard to use for agriculture. That existed for a very long time. So agriculturalists were fighting with one another for most of human history. And then the next major revolution in terms of energy was the Industrial Revolution. So this was huge, right? So if you look at just about every metric of human progress, so child mortality rates, lifespan, health, size of our polities, war-making capacity, anything you want, it kind of looks flat, right? So all of those things you learned about as important as, you know, the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, it doesn't really touch these metrics until we get to this inflection point that was the Industrial Revolution, where everything kind of just takes off. And that was really on the back of our ability to use stored sunlight, which was in the ground. Right, so millions of years worth of photosynthesis through peat turned to black rock that we call coal initially, and zooplankton and algae turned to oil and natural gas. We unlock those batteries and we use them to multiply human effort in an unprecedented scale, first in England, then Western Europe, and then across the world. So that's the first law, energy. And that kind of puts a ceiling on our efforts. The second law is the law of innovation or efficiency. So once we figure this stuff out, what we do is we figure out how to do more with the same amount of energy, right? So what economists and engineers are really doing is figuring out more efficient ways to get the same or better product out of something. And that's how you make money in the world, right? So why is Jeff Bezos so rich? Because he found a more efficient way to get you stuff that you want that put, you know, strip malls and high streets out of business, right? You get these vertical efficiencies. The light bulb, you know, we were burning incandescent light bulbs or candles first, very inefficient. Most of it's heat, not a lot of light. And then we get to like incandescent light bulbs. I think it's about 7%, if I recall, efficiency. Most of that's still lost to heat. And eventually you get to like the same amount of light being produced in LEDs, close to 100% efficiency, using far, far less energy, right? So to the point where, you know, this idea that we should turn off the lights to save energy is a pointless activity. It's nothing anymore. Turn off your kettle if you want. Okay, so that's the law of efficiency. So you have this kind of space between the efficiency which you can do things and the energy ceiling that you have access to. And there's particular metrics that I go into the book, the energy return on investment and so on. But all of the human activity comes about in this kind of surplus that once we get beyond like feeding ourselves, there's a surplus to do other stuff like go on vacation and, you know, build yachts and fly in space and do all these other things that you can't do if you're at subsistence levels. The third law is that our ability to do any of what I just described is never a lonely act, right? Our greatest achievements and our worst atrocities are always collective acts, right? Through government, through companies, through scientific teams, whatever it might be, we come together to achieve more than we could achieve by ourselves. But the question is, how large should that collective be? Like, how large should a country be? How large should a company be? How large should a scientific team be? And the heuristic in the law of cooperation is simply that the per unit return on energy really should be higher than it would be if you were in a smaller group or a larger group. So if you, just to use an analogy that is accurate, if you imagine like a company going after some market share, right? So there's a total market share that's available to you. There's a particular size of that. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear that airplane flying over.
You're not in Zanzibar, are you?
I'm not. I'm actually on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, Australia. but you kind of caught me in Zanzibar. So the amount of energy that... the size of the group. So if let's see. If you imagine like a company, if I could build a company all by myself, I don't need employees, I don't need funders, you know, Y Combinator can go to hell. I don't need any of that stuff. I would do it. I would take 100% of the equity, and I would be a multi-trillionaire all by myself. I can't do that. I have to get other people involved. I have to cooperate with other people. Now, how many is that? Do I need like hundreds of thousands of people? Do I need 10 people? You're kind of searching the market by expanding and contracting, you know, so Musk buys X and he realizes actually, you know, we can drop 80% of the workforce and just get by, right? So the market is kind of finding those efficiencies, but the scale of that cooperation is ultimately determined by how much, by cooperating, we can access something that we couldn't have accessed did we not cooperate. So hunter-gatherers at the scales that they operate at could not access oil and natural gas. It just requires an ecosystem of pipelines and protecting those pipelines and oil rigs and so on that they just couldn't do, even if they had the technology to do so, right? So that's the law of cooperation. And the final law is the law of evolution, which is simply that these are not designed solutions. The world looks like it was designed in the same way that organisms look like they're designed. But to a great extent, it's an evolutionary process with a little bit of human ingenuity, right? So we talk about the design of the U.S. Constitution, but it wasn't the only constitution that was created, right? We don't talk about Brazil's constitution because it wasn't successful. We talk about the Magna Carta, but it wasn't the only, you know, the first attempt at constraining the king. There were many attempts that failed. And what we are seeing is the kind of end product of a kind of trial and error process whereby humans try different things that we think are going to work, and a few of them actually succeed. And this is true everywhere, right? I mean, in business, you know, in the tech sector, unicorns are unicorns because they're rare, and most attempts at a startup fail. But what we get by that attempt is this kind of evolutionary process by which some people are trying things with different numbers of people, with different technology, different ideas, and the best rise to the top, and the others learn from it. And this is what we call cultural evolution. So those are the four laws, okay. And with those, you can explain most of the world.
Okay, so I mean, if we just dial down energy, how do you think about that impact on innovation cooperation?
So fundamentally, in physics, there's this idea of effective theories, right? So there are theories that you don't need to know about quarks for the most part if you're doing chemistry. It's just not the level that you're interested in. You care about protons and neutrons and electrons. That's the world of chemistry. And when you're doing economics, for the most part, maybe you don't need to know that much about the biology. Maybe you can ignore it. It's not the kind of effective theory. But ultimately, the only laws that actually exist in the world are physical laws. Like everything else is kind of arbitrary. Energy is the one currency that unifies the whole system. And it's hard to see because all of economics, all of, you know, our schooling systems, all of psychology, all of these fields emerged really after the Industrial Revolution, after which we lived in effectively a positive sum world. We exited the Malthusian trap in part because of this access to underlying energy forces. But it's still there. It's, you know, I describe it, you know, I use Wallace's analogy of it's like the water, right? Fish don't see the water until it disappears. We don't see the fact that we can travel across the globe or talk to one another or build AI or use our microwaves or anything because we have access to untold amounts of energy that our ancestors never had access to. We could not build the world that we exist in today on the back of wood. We need kind of fossil fuels, and now we can transition maybe to solar and nuclear. But fundamentally, that ceiling still exists. Like if we, you know, there's a tight relationship between kind of economic growth and just the price of electricity, because that's what powers the whole thing. It's the thing hidden in the background that keeps things going. So Britain builds itself on the back of cheap and available coal, and its kind of economy tracks, you know, the coal mines. It gets a little bit of a boost with the North Sea oil, and now it's kind of returned to the levels it was at if it had not discovered all of that oil. We had a kind of stillborn nuclear age. You know, there's this wonderful report by Sam Bowman and co. on foundations. Why I live in Britain, so I think a little bit about it, or at least I part-time living in Britain at this point. You know, and it's really just about differences across the continent. And one of the best things I love about this is, so France don't work quite as hard as the Brits do, but they have similar outputs. And they don't have to because they have such a large, in their energy mix, reliance on nuclear. And one of my favorite anecdotes is the French are constantly protesting. They're constantly not working to the point where they invented a great French innovation, a grill, like a barbecue that travels along the tram tracks so that they can grill while they protest, which happens so often that they need this invention. But they can do it because they have this vast source of energy. Now, once you have enough energy, then energy doesn't matter anymore. You know, so once you have enough of it, you can stop thinking about it, and other things matter in terms of innovation and efficiency and so on. And why I brought it kind of back to the fore in this book is because there is reason to believe that we're not quite as energy abundant as we once were. We're doing things more efficiently, which is kind of compensated for the energy ceiling falling on us. But if you look at something like oil discovery rates, and you look at one metric that I find useful here, which is the energy return on investment, so the amount of energy it takes to get some amount of energy back, that has been falling precipitously, right? So, you know, I think it was in the early 20th century, you know, one barrel of oil found you another 100 barrels. And by 1950, one barrel of oil found you another 50 barrels. And, you know, by 2010, one barrel of oil found you another 5 barrels, right? So, yes, we have access to other energy, but they aren't quite as high on the energy return on investment as fossil fuels are.
Okay. And maybe if you can clarify why you speak in terms of energy as opposed to resources in general, like what that distinction is, because I think there is some overlap there, right? Like the more energy, the more abundance you have in general when it comes to energy or resources, the easier it is to cooperate. That's kind of like a basic kind of game theory dynamic.
Yeah, so it's true. So I mean, other resources matter, but often, you know, the access to those other resources. So there are kind of limiting reagents, if this was like a chemistry analogy, like but typically that limiting reagent is a matter of energy cost, right? Like we can have a city like Phoenix in the desert because we can pump water out to Phoenix because we have such vast reserves of energy. We couldn't do that otherwise. There are serious, like other very, very serious limiting agents like phosphorus, for example, which I don't think is sufficiently on people's agenda, but for the most part, things are kind of fungible. You can swap them out, and it's just a matter of, do you have enough energy to extract it? Or do you have new technologies that can make it energy cheaper to access it? You know, remember Napoleon used to have a dinnerware set that was made of aluminum, because aluminum was incredibly expensive, because it costs a lot of energy to extract aluminum until we discovered new ways of doing it. And then, you know, he can make like a can of Coke out of it. So there is no, we're not, on my reading of it, we're not at a point where these other resources that we have outside of, let's say, phosphorus, actually matter all that much. And if we kind of crack that next level, you know, we're able to access resources that are extraplanetary through asteroid mining or whatever it might be, then the whole thing goes away. But again, fundamentally, the limiting thing here is energy, unless you have something else in mind. So we can fight over water. We can fight over, you know, oil. Oil is, of course, energy. We can fight over other things.
Yeah, I think there's other limiting things, I think. But we can get to that in a second. Actually,
Can I just say one more thing to defend that? Just to say that at a local level, there's definitely other limiting agents. So within a particular country, you probably don't have access to enough lithium or something. Or water or whatever it might be. But at a humanity level, which is what I'm primarily interested in, at the level of humanity, we're not limited by anything other than our access to energy.
Okay. Let's keep that in mind as we discuss these next set of topics. So now that you've kind of laid out your theory, we kind of understand the basic dynamics between these four laws of life. Let's shift gears to solutions. You know, we have climate change, we have a collapsing biosphere in general, we have inequality, wealth inequality, we have AI potentially destroying the economy any day now. You know, we've got the loneliness epidemic. So we've got all these problems. How does your theory of everyone, or how can we use your theory of everyone rather, to address some of these problems?
Yeah, so just to create the link with what I just said, and then I'll kind of get into some of the details on some of the topics you said, which is simply that, first off, you know, some people's immediate reaction to some of these challenges is, look, the climate is a problem. What we need to do is kind of cut back right? Like we should be more sustainable. We need to reduce our consumption or something. But it's the places that are consuming the most, that have the most kind of energy surplus, if you like, or just wealth surplus, if you just want to, you know, if you want to think about it the way you would typically think about it. Those are the places that actually have the budget, both financial and literally in energy terms, to be able to solve these problems. So, you know, if you are in a poorer country, you are living at a lower standard of living, you are using less resources, but you have to, you're Brazil or something, you have to actually clear some of that rainforest so you can afford to feed your people. I'm currently in Australia, right? Australia has, you know, has some of the highest household wealth in the world. I think it's the one place in the world that more Americans move to Australia than Australians move to America. It has enough in its budget to care a lot about its environment, to take a hit, not access some of its, you know, uranium resources, plow money into repairing the Great Barrier Reef, protecting vast amounts, because it's such a wealthy country. So, you know, a world of abundance gives you more options, right? Having more money in your budget allows you to decide what you want to do with it. All of these problems that we face, growth, a kind of clean growth, one that's, you know, that considers the cost of our environment and other things, that is the path to resolving them, rather than a kind of let's all back. And that comes out of the law of evolution, which is simply to say that if you decide you're not going to have any children, for example, that's fine. But those who do have children will replace you in equilibrium over time. If you decide I'm going to cut back and our economy is not going to grow, that's fine. But you are going to be outcompeted on the global marketplace, and eventually all your stuff's going to get bought and controlled by those who are still growing. It's not a sustainable solution to be sustainable where you are trying to cut back on growth. The line has to go up.
It's not sustainable to be outcompeted.
Yeah. It's not sustainable to be outcompeted. But more importantly, you know, in some of our research, we have a working paper on this, but it also falls out of just standard growth models. The line has to go up to not be in a zero-sum world. If the line flattens, your loss is my gain, and then we're kind of back in a kind of Malthusian reality.
Yeah, is that always true? Is that due to kind of the cultural software that we're dealing with? You know, so, I think we had, or you had brought up the example of the Hadza tribe, I believe. Hadza tribe, yeah. Where they have, you know, because they had limited resources, they were more egalitarian. And you can kind of see this trend in hunter-gatherer societies.
Totally, yeah.
Does that not imply that if we were more culturally enlightened, let's say, you know, we could not have to worry about endless growth?
Yeah. So the Hadza are a great example. I mean, the Hadza are the ultimate degrowth society. And, you know, all of the things that you would expect go hand in hand, right? So they are low productivity, highly egalitarian, which is the point where if anyone tries to produce more or tries to stand up, they kind of squash them back down. And they're highly sustainable. You know, they live in accordance with the land. But just like with other hunter-gatherer groups, they're outcompeted even by simple agriculturalists. So the problem you have is, like, what are you going to do? How are you going to convince the agriculturalists to live like the Hadza? They don't want to. They don't want to live like hunter-gatherers, right? It's not an equilibrium solution. You know, if your theory of change is, if only everyone would do X, I would say you've got a problem. Because if X is not incentive compatible, at least a few people are not going to do X. And what you're going to require is like high levels of coercion in order to force people to do X. And unless you can do that globally, then other people are going to want to do things. So I think what you want to do is try to find solutions that are more incentive compatible, really, that are evolutionarily compatible. They're compatible in equilibrium in every sense of that word.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's keep going though on the kind of solutions that you propose.
I just want to say though, it's not to say that like it's not a good idea to. There are better and worse ways to seek status in the world, right? So, you know, if billionaires are using their money to, you know, buy rainforests and burn them down, obviously they're not, but if they were, that would be worse than if they were using their money to think about ways to increase growth in low growth areas or something, right? So the things that people find prestigious are open to selection, they are open to cultural change, and there are better and worse things. I'm just saying those things are at the margins compared to some of the more extreme versions of let's live like the Hadza.
Yeah, and actually I didn't want to bring this up at this point, but I think a lot of these issues, honestly, I think they require tremendous international coordination, because you still have the competitive issue. If that's the direction you're going, you're saying we're not going to be egalitarian, we're going to go the competitive route because that's where the incentives are, and all it takes is one person to start, you know, trying to outcompete you, to, you know, cause an arms race and yada yada. Like, you still need, at some level, to prevent kind of self-destruction, you need to coordinate. And so ultimately, you know, we may get to a point where that is the, you know, the end game cannot just be continual competition. There has to be some sort of system in place to, again, with proper incentives, not through like just straight coercion, but like there has to be some system that at some point in our evolution as a species that counteracts just the mindless sort of competitive
dynamics. Yeah, but so I guess, you know, the way I think about things is we're looking for the kind of adjacent possibilities that, you know, move the system toward a better place than a kind of worse place. And, you know, competition can be good if it's productive competition and not destructive competition. People actually want to live in a place that isn't polluted and is, you know, is biodiverse and is clean. People want that. Around the world, people want that.
I agree. But you know, the problem is I would say a lot of people, like most people do want that. But the problem is like most people, like the normal person is being outcompeted by, I think, sociopaths and people who care less, who are able to climb those power structures more effectively. Right. And we're kind of, you know, just under that situation.
We do need to constrain bad actors, and you know, and part of how people achieve living in that nicer world is that we kind of outsource the bad stuff to someone else, right? So it could be within your country, you've got effectively a vast army of poorer people that are allowing you to sustain your lifestyle, or if you're a very wealthy country, you've outsourced your pollution and you've outsourced your, you know, environmental destruction to China or somewhere else. But you want a system where eventually they are also growing and they are also demanding a better, cleaner quality of life. So we're all kind of heading toward a better place. We are aspiring toward a better world for everyone. And in the book, I do, you know, I do deal with like how could you, what might actually allow you to achieve this? And one thing is just thinking about, you know, what money is, right? Like money is a vote. It is a vote on how we devote our goods and services, like our energy budget. And the design of our system decides how that vote is allocated. So one of the things you can have is a world in which you are incentivizing people who produce more to, you know, who make the world better for everyone within some constraints. You incentivize them by giving them more of that vote. We call that money, right? So you have... by the rules that we've agreed to in a capitalistic kind of environment, you have created value that other people agree with. We now drive electric cars, or I prefer to buy things online, or whatever it might be. You've created that in a way that other people who can vote have decided on it, rather than kind of rent-seeking ways of control, right? So, you know, there's an argument that Britain has been under occupation since 1066 by the Normans, right? You have vast tracts of land that have held basically in the same families for 1,000 years, and there's no movement there. It's just fully, and they will never lose that. So, you know, one of the big things that I push for in terms of a fair system of taxation is one that's based on land value rather than anything else. For everything that humans can own, right? So patents or equities or even artwork or something. The one thing we didn't create was the land, and it's the one thing that economists across the political spectrum, you know, liberal, conservatives, whatever you might like, say this is the least distortionary form of tax. All other taxes are highly distortionary. Like, take income tax. Only existence in the United States since 1912. Highly distortionary.
Has a land value tax been implemented anywhere, and how have those results
in different ways, for sure, yeah. So, I mean, Norway has a kind of land value tax in its sovereign fund through its access to the North Sea oil. So when people think of land value tax, they think value on my home. No, it's mostly the most valuable land is stuff where there's stuff under the ground, right? And that dividends is shared across every Norwegian. Alaska has a dividend that's given to all people. And then, you know, other places have implemented land value taxes. And what it typically does is it drives development and it causes there to be the most efficient use of that land. And then you can constrain that in different ways, you know, along environmental protections, for example, to ensure that that development isn't so crazy that you're destroying all the greenery to extract value from that land.
Okay. But in places that don't have abundant natural resources like oil or something, like, can you just go into more detail about how, because, you know, you hear the claims, and I mean, you talk about it in your book, that you can kind of just replace all taxes, income tax, sales tax, et cetera,
depends on the
with
place.
A land value tax. Yeah.
It depends on the country, and it depends on what the current taxation is, right? So if you're a country that's very small, it's not like Singapore or something, they do have a kind of land value tax, but you're not going to replace all of the business taxes and the income taxes with just land, because you don't have that much of it, even though the land you do have is highly valuable. And you already have a kind of land value tax. In the United States, you probably can replace a huge chunk of it. In Britain, you probably can replace a huge chunk of it. So it's highly dependent. But I think, you know, it's one of those things that we're highly incentivized to not talk about it because of kind of vested interests. It's one of the places you can kind of store your capital, but it would be better for everyone. We want to be, again, you know, you can't, with all of these things, you know, people want revolution. They want like immediate change. You've created a system that was fair at the time, and outside of like a true revolution, you can't just like overnight change it. What you wanted, because it's unfair to those who have made you know, asset allocation decisions based on the old system. So what you want to do is kind of nudge the system where you want to be. So you start with like a low land value tax of 1%, 2%, and you compensate it by reducing in taxes in other areas that you want people to be invested. So maybe lower on CGT or inheritance tax or income tax or whatever it might be, so that for most people it's net neutral, and it allows them the time to reallocate their resources, and eventually moves the system to a better place. Rather than a kind of overnight. It's highly distortionary otherwise. I mean, if house prices fall overnight because somebody just implemented 100% land tax, it would be a massive shock to the system, and it would be disastrous.
Right. Okay, yeah. So that's a land value tax. What are some other proposals that you have?
So in terms of my career right now, so I mean, there's a few things I should say about myself. The first is, never wanted to be an academic. Kind of accidentally fell into it. I was an engineer, you know, and I was making good money as an engineer. I was very good at it. I've been programming since I was like 7 years old. But I, you know, wasn't very fulfilling, and money itself isn't a massive motivator for me. I wanted to see, like, could we solve some of the problems that other people are ignoring? And I'm finally at the stage in my career where I'm a full professor. I'm joint appointed between NYU and LSE. I'd like to really look for kind of what I call Archimedes levers, right? Like, what are the kinds of things that a small group of committed people can really jump on and move the world, and in ways that target some of the biggest challenges that we face. So I'll go through a few of these. So the first is that our societies are coming apart, in part because I think there has been, you know, both artificial and real resource constraints, right? So we had financial crises, for example, that shoved us into a zero-sum world. There's some really nice work by Jean-Paul Carvalho, Nathan Nunn, and some others, where they show that, you know, economic slow growth results in more awkward hostility and just general things that are associated with zero-sumness, which means your loss is my gain, my loss is your gain, rather than a kind of we can both compete productively. And that is exacerbated by the fact that we are now living in a far more multicultural society with people, you know, if you buy my thesis of where I started, is that humans have almost speciated along cultural lines. We think so differently, and we don't often recognize just how differently we think about the world, right? Some societies.
I do, just because I'm an immigrant, but I agree with you. A lot of people don't.
For anyone who's experienced a lot of, you know, especially very diverse cultures, like very different cultures. Yeah. It's intuitive and obvious, right? In the same way that you speak multiple languages, you can see how language can be structured quite differently. If you only speak Indo-European languages, then language is language, right? So, you know, like in many places around the world, your decisions are not your own to make. They're decided by a community of people, maybe your family. In many places, cousin marriage is very common, and you have tribal loyalties that are bound together because you don't have a family tree. The traditional family is not traditional. What you really have is a family web. And those tribes and the obligations surrounding those tribes undermine democracies, and they undermine institutions. those, you know, there are kind of follow-ons from that around what those obligations might be. So we often talk about a kin tax, sometimes called a black tax, where, you know, a Nigerian doctor or a black doctor in South Africa makes less money than a white doctor, not only because of wage differentials, but also because his entire family wants a piece of that, and he feels an obligation to do that. You know, I have friends from the Philippines who, to this day, two generations on, are still sending money back to the Philippines because they can't think of it in any other way. So these are very different ways of viewing the world. And that includes things around cooperation. You know, is it the right thing to support your family member when they've done something wrong? One of my, you know, favorite bits of research on this is by a psychologist, Franz Trapenau, where he asked people, he said, listen, you're driving along a road. In your car with you is your cousin, your brother, your friend, whatever you want. You drive along this road and he accidentally hits somebody. And the judge says, listen, you were the only other witness apart from the person that got hit. If you lie to the to your cousin, brother, whatever, friend gets off. The question is, should you lie for them? Does your cousin have a you know, should they have a reasonable expectation that you should lie for them? And would you do it? And this is like a massive kind of cleavage in the world. So you ask people in Norway, they're like, no, you do the crime, you do the time. You know, you ask people in New England, you know, absolutely not. I would, what do you mean? Like, they hit somebody. Are you kidding me? And in other places, they're like, it's a stranger. I don't care. Like, what do you, of course I would lie for my friend, cousin, brother, whatever. Like, what do you, the courts? Who cares about the government? What do you mean? Like, of course I would, you know. So, you know, this is like a major cleavage in the world. And there are many others of this kind that we are not even able to talk about properly. We don't have the language to talk about it, that are causing divisions in our society. You know, I don't want to date your, I don't want to date your podcast, but you know, right now there's a discussion around Minnesota and Somalians and you know, whatever. But in any one moment, there's, you know, these are uncovered. We talk about them. We don't even know how to think about them. But these are important. So immigration has driven immigration concerns and cultural concerns have driven geopolitics, certainly domestic geopolitics, for a very long time. You know, like if you look at Brexit in the UK, a massive amount of those concerns was just people coming across the border. Every government since at least 97, you know, probably earlier, has made the claim that they would try to stop the flow of illegal immigrants, if not immigrants overall. And every government has either lied or has been unable to fulfill that promise. And that's a problem because, you know, we often think about democracy as free and fair elections. But that isn't what democracy is. That is the means by which we achieve democracy. Democracy is the degree to which the will of the people is expressed through the decisions of government. And in this domain, the will of the people has not been expressed through government. And again, because you know, it's a little closer to home, in the UK, you've got a serious problem. If you ignore, you can only ignore people for so long. What do? They'll vote for the other party. Then they'll vote for a different party. They'll try to protest. They kick the country out of the EU. Eventually, you're going to have blood on the streets if you don't. And people recognize that. And so what are they doing? They're squashing civil liberties to prevent what they see as the cause of it. But that's not the cause of it. The cause of it is people's real concerns that their will is not being expressed through the decisions of government. So how do you tackle that problem? From my perspective, because I'm concerned with humanity rather than any particular multiple citizenships and all that, you know, rather than any particular country, I see it as a kind of push-pull, you know, supply and demand problem. One of the challenges that we face is that a lot of places around the world are terrible places to live, and we do not have a good model of development. And so people in those places over the course of time will flow across into other places. And if the institutions and the culture and the society isn't prepared to absorb them and culturally absorb them, so they assimilate to some degree, so you preserve those institutions, you're in trouble. So, and climate change exacerbates that, right? So I'll give you a couple of things. So one is that the Syrian migration crisis, which led to a lot of the downstream effects, was in part catalyzed by climate change, right? So the crops failed in the rural areas. People flooded to the cities. There weren't enough jobs to go around because, you know, if you're going to absorb more people, you need to expand the number of places in schools and hospitals so you don't feel that zero-sumness. It's like, I can't get an appointment. I can't get my kid into the good school anymore. And so they were protests. And then you've got kind of, you know, the Assad regime and how they reacted to that. And you've got Russia and you've got all kinds of things going on that are very specific. But eventually you've got a migration crisis. That's on Europe's doorstep, floods across. And this in turn has effects on Britain, which in turn has effects on the United States. You know, these things are all connected to one another. There's a bigger concern. One of the last places that are actually creating humans is Africa. It's the youngest continent, right? Average age, you know, still in the 20s. Those people are rapidly urbanizing. And if you don't do anything about how that happens, they're typically in slums with low educational opportunities, low job opportunities, and low kind of, you know, outlook on life. What do you think is going to happen to those people? It's going to be endemic in crime. You're going to have like civil conflict within those regions. And it's going to be very tempting to make the trip, especially, you know, from West and North Africa across the Mediterranean into Europe. So we need a better model of development. Aid has had a checkered history, right? So aid can catalyze things. It can catalyze education, which can then have downstream effects. It can catalyze health, which can then have downstream effects. But for the most part, a lot of it has, you know, at least maybe it's not recently, but historically been abused to sustain corrupt regimes. You know, Dembisa Moya has this book, Dead Aid, but, you know, others have written and talked about this as well.
Right, for the benefit of wealthier nations. I mean, to be clear,
For the benefit of, exactly. So, you know, if you're a multinational corporation, you want the Congo's resources, you pay off a small group of elite, aid comes in, whatever it might be, you get to control the resources.
The history of Congo is insane, by the way. People should read about it. I mean, it's just agreed. Like the amount of resources they have and just the corruption and
like, should be the most wealthy country in the world.
It's beyond comprehension.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So how do you solve that? How do you solve that, right? So you've got these, you know, these political kludges. You've got, this is where, you know, I think this theory of everyone, you know, like, so again, as an academic, you have two choices, right? So one is you can spend your life trying to convince people that your view of the world is correct and they should all buy it. Or you can just go do it, right? If you think you've got the periodic table and you think everyone's doing alchemy, just go do some chemistry and stop, you know, ignore the people turning lead into gold, right? And so that's where I'm at. So it's like, well, how do we do that? So one model that I think is very promising is the idea of a startup city. And that, you know, you alluded to Zanzibar. That's what we're building in Zanzibar, right? You build a city because we have been able to do that in the past. And part of it, you know, in collaboration with an organization called the Charter Cities Institute, we've looked at the 250, maybe 300 or so new cities around the world in the last couple of hundred years and looked at what worked and what didn't to create a governance handbook, which anyone can go read online. Tried to sell that to governments. There was a wonderful opportunity in Zanzibar with a new president of Tanzania, Zanzibari. Historically, there's been a conflict between Zanzibar and Tanzania, which has now come to an end. Zanzibar, because of its kind of like Canada distinguishes itself from the United States, Zanzibar distinguishes itself from Tanzania and wants to do better, right? They have their own semi-autonomous government. There's the potential to create these new startup cities, you know, these new charter cities, startup cities, whatever you might call them, endogenously. So the government creates them. We're just kind of advising and making sure things go well. How do you build a startup city? Well, we did. It happened in Hong Kong. Took a long time. British institutions, British culture combined with local things turns a 8,000 person fishing village into a metropolis. Singapore is effectively a startup city. And then China. So remember, when Hong Kong was handed back to China in 97, it was 20% of the Chinese economy, right? And now it's like 2%, not because like Hong Kong shrunk, because China built off that engine of development and did it again with Shenzhen and Guangzhou, right? And other, you know, these kinds of special economic zones. So how do you do it? The first thing is normally garments. We can go straight to tech. I'll just highlight some of the things that, you know, big achievements there. One is that IIT, so the Indian Institute for Technology, which creates Silicon Valley software engineers, they were looking for their first international campus because India is trying to, you know, stretch its soft power arm. That first campus is in Zanzibar, in the city, right? So you've got kind of MIT, or you got Stanford, now you want kind of Harvard as well. Leonard Wontchekin, who, if you give me time, is a Princeton economist who has a fascinating history, the son of farmers, rebel, arrested, gets his degree in like age 30, becomes a full professor at Princeton in economics. Fascinating character. He's got this African School of Economics, set up a campus there. This was 2023, and now 2024 was the African School of Economics. There's the Silicon Zanzibar project. My point is you want to create a situation where you're lifting people, the money is splashing around, it's like Hong Kong, and then it'll spread. you want to give people opportunities to, because they have choices, right? To take the money and be corrupt, or, you know, find ways to actually make money legitimately. And if you can create those opportunities, you just shift the calculus slightly alongside other, you know, bits of pressure. You can actually shift the world. If we had a model of development that we could literally, like, we had a startup model we could create here and here and here, that helps solve the push factor. Which then, you know, alongside legal changes to prevent people from abusing the, you know, the benefit system, you can't have democracy and a social welfare system and, you know, untapped immigration. You just can't. Alongside those helps solve some of those problems, right? We can pick any of these things, you know, fertility crisis, climate change, whatever. And each of them has different ways of looking at the same problem, because you've got this new lens about how humans and social change operate.
Okay. Let's maybe just explore the startup cities a little bit more.
Sure.
I think the goal there is to have multiple startup cities and then to see what actually works, right? I mean, you've already done an analysis on existing kind of scenarios that are similar.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Is the scale of these projects, I mean, they're inherently smaller than, I mean, you're not looking at a size of New York or Mexico City or something, right? Like, these are inherently pretty small, and the dynamics.
Geographically, it is. Geographically, it's the size of Manhattan. And, you know, the ultimate
but like
aim,
population,
course,
I mean, the population not yet. Wise.
No, of course not.
Right. So I feel like the scale changes these dynamics immensely, right? And so how do you extrapolate? Because, I mean, it's like something might work at a small scale, but it doesn't at a larger scale, which is what ultimately we want, right?
Yeah. So, you know, you always have to look at your counterfactual. It's like, what is your alternative model, right? What is the development model that you have in mind that you think goes straight to scale? The reason that I think the startup city model does scale is because it has over and over again. You know, when Shenzhen just first started, it wasn't a lot of people. But when those how do you drive development? Create opportunities for people to legitimately make money and get out of the way, and people will come. That's what happened with Hong Kong. That's what happened with Singapore. That's what happened with Shenzhen. People come for the opportunities. And then it does scale, because eventually everyone wants a piece of that. And so they, you know, they learn from it, they copy it, and the thing expands out into, ideally, all of Zanzibar. It looks like this new model of governance. Do you see what I mean? So again, it's a very evolutionary way of thinking about it. You're introducing a random mutation that has the possibility, like, you know, if this was an invasion analysis, that's a bad analogy. Cut that from what I just said.
That's all right. But in the yeah. So in these examples, is the key that you're pointing out is we have stable economic situation. Like good opportunities, and that is the driving factor. Is there anything else in terms of like governance structures?
Remember, you know, so again, you know, if you think, you know, remember what I said earlier, which is that the world was never, it was never designed, it evolved.
Right.
And if you look at these other startup cities, it's not, we are terrible at transplanting institutions, right? Like what typically happens is that the ones that work are recombined with local culture. I lived for like 6 years in Botswana. Botswana has Westminster style parliament, but it is recombined with the local institutions. The first president of Botswana, Soret Sekama, was democratically elected, but he was the big chief. And everyone was like, of course we're going to vote for the big chief because he's the big chief. And they, you know, and Botswana has pre-democratic institutions like the Kgotla, where, you know, they vote among all the chiefs, you know, what they are going to decide to do next. And so you've already got a scaffolding upon which you can build something out. It's not that, you know, like in other places where, you know, colonial powers try to impose their government, it just worked. Like Liberia, right, has the United States' flag and model of government and all this stuff. And it doesn't work. It fails. You know, Papua New Guinea looks a lot like, you know, it doesn't have the bicameral house, but it looks a lot like Australia's government system. But it doesn't look anything like Australia in terms of its outcomes. But if you look at the successes, Japan, South Korea, it's that you give people the opportunity, you show them that it works, and you allow the thing to transmit and recombine locally into something new that we haven't seen before. We're not trying to design efficient institutions. We're trying to evolve them. We're trying to create a startup system, like a startup ecosystem that has the mechanisms that allow for something to evolve. If I were to just give you one analogy to this, you know, in and sometimes it happens by accident. We're just trying to do it on purpose, right? So California and California and Silicon Valley has a really good system for allowing startups to compete but also learn from one another. And part of that is because there's an obscure law from the 19th century that prevents someone from interfering with your ability to get a job, which made non-compete agreements null and void. And that meant that in this particular place, when a startup emerges, they have to hang on to their employees, because anyone else can, if you want something from someone else, you can just poach them entirely. You can just poach the entire team to, you know, and take the IP in that way. That's a very unique situation that is conducive to an evolutionary process, and it happened by accident. And again, you know, as I go through the book, we see the same rules, this law of evolution combined with the law of cooperation and law of innovation occur again and again and again. Right? The Catholic Church can maintain itself. Microsoft changes under Nadella under the same system. Anyway, go on. You want to ask?
I was going to ask. What are we selecting for here, or what is being selected for just organically? Is it simply
growth and
its ability and to just governance. Grow and the population is kind of growing and stable, stable in terms of like economically stable, like, you know, politically stable, et cetera.
Yeah. That's right. All of the things that we think about as stable, well-governed societies that most of us want to live in, by the choices that we make through migration patterns, we're trying to create that environment, but that, you know, that looks like a local version of that, because it's not, we're not all trying to get, I think it's Fukuyama said, you know, trying to get to Denmark. We're not all kind of get to Denmark because we don't all want to be Danish. We don't have Danish culture. We wouldn't accept a lot of Danish norms, but we're approaching something like that.
But I guess it's all being sort of still, it's all kind of under the umbrella of the global economic paradigm, which is about growth, which is about, and I know you think that's more inherent to life itself, but, you know, it's just, it feels like everything kind of just gets optimized for almost GDP, which is like, we want to be mindful of like not optimizing for particular metrics, because we know like, hey, yes, we've created these advanced, stable societies, and we've got all this cool technology, and people aren't as violent, you know, and so on. However, like, you know, you do these studies on happiness, and you find some of these hunter-gatherer these modern hunter-gatherer tribes are actually happier. You find places that are less economically well off; they can be happier, not always, but like, you know, it's. It's not obvious like what we should optimize for or select for under the paradigm that we're in is the thing that we ultimately want humanity to, you know, trend toward.
So I'm not in the business of telling people what they should want or want. I'm in the business of creating the opportunities for people, you know, Amartya Sen style, right? Like for people to live lives that they themselves value and consider valuable. So, you know, it is inherently very difficult to do cross-country comparisons of happiness because of kind of measurement issues, like, you know, happiness compared to how I was before, happiness compared to, you know, relative to other people, relative to other countries. You know, a lot of Scandinavian countries are very aware of their happiness indices and how they answer these questions, right? And these are, you know, these are stated preferences. I'm looking, you know, the reveal preference is, are you moving to these places? I'm not seeing a massive exodus of people from the urban centers moving to live like the Hadza, even those, you know, who are very close by. I'm seeing people moving out of the urban, moving out of these rural environments to be in the big cities and enjoy this. And it's not because they're watching things necessarily on TV. They have higher lifespans and better health and more opportunities to grow and expand and learn and figure things out. I'm not in the business of telling people what they want from their lives. And GDP is an imperfect measure. And I don't think it's the only thing that anyone is trying to optimize on. But I do think that capitalism has its flaws, but there are versions of it that are better aligned with what we understand about how an evolutionary system works. What we want is a fairer, more efficient form of capitalism. So one that reduces, for example, incentives toward rent seeking, right? One that creates greater matches between talent and opportunity so that the happenstance of your birth doesn't limit what you can do. and one that also considers the full cost of any particular person, company's activities on other people, and that includes the environmental cost of what people are doing. That's all, right? So it's not good enough to criticize the model. You have to build a better model, and you have to demonstrate, and you have to show it. And I'm not seeing that alternative. You know, capitalism has lifted millions out of poverty. It has resulted in, by every metric you might use, forget, you're right about, I'll come back to the happiness thing in a second, but, you know, by every metric in terms of child mortality and, you know, people migrating to what they prefer away from what they prefer less, lifespans and so on, capitalism has done a lot of work, and I'd like to see what the alternative looks like. You know, so if we go back to like the old debate on communism, I really like what E.O. Wilson said. So, you know, E.O. Wilson was the Harvard entomologist who worked on, like, you know, ants, bees, that kind of thing. And he said, communism is a great system. It's just the wrong species. You know, it really works well for ants and bees. It's just, it's not well aligned with the way that humans work. And I think he's right. So I think that, you know, like land value taxes being a good example of that, you know, there are ways to make capitalism more efficient. And by the way, there's all kinds of problems we now face, by the way. So, like, one example is we have such vast wealth inequality. Like, it's so just, you know, with population size and the ability to scale and therefore make a lot more money. Like, you can make a lot more money with 7 billion people in the world than you can make with 1 million people by selling, you know, 5-cent widgets to everyone, let's say. The level of inequality is so enormous. Like, it beggars, like, people do not understand it. You know, I've tried to use time as a way to say this, you know. A millionaire is 2 weeks. You know, a billionaire is 32 years if a dollar were a second. You know, and we're talking about people with like multiple billions, right? So that's fine in terms of their, you know, as long as how they are acquiring that billion comes from actually expanding the pie in some way, right? The problem is what happens after that. Like, what happens to those vote shares in goods and services and energy once that innovator dies? It's a serious problem that, you know, the highest net worth individuals face. Do they give it back to the government? Like, is that a good way? Like, is the government an efficient way to handle that money? Do they create a foundation of some kind, a trust of some kind? Is that distortionary? Is that the best way to handle it? Do they give out a dividend? You know, I mean, this is another way to just give it out to the population. Everyone gets a share of it, whatever. There's different ways to handle it, but it's a serious thing that I think as this largish population of very high net worth individuals think about legacy and passing on, they have to make a big decision around it. Foundations from the 20th century were a kind of, I think, kicking it down the road solution.
Gotcha. Okay, so you said a lot there. I'm trying to make sure I can address some of it. So to be clear, if I can circle back to the point about trying to dictate what people should do or what people should want, I don't mean to imply that I know what people should be doing, what they should want, and how we should exactly structure society. What I was trying to get at, though, is just by virtue of the economic paradigm that we're in, that already orients us in a certain direction. So it's not like we're not going in any direction and that we're in a perfectly like neutral state. I think they're like the systems that we have in place encourage and incentivize certain types of behavior that may not necessarily, you know, be the case otherwise if we had different kind of culture and different systems. And so I'm merely questioning, like, is the just the overarching paradigm, is that the one that we want to guide us to the future when it has? Sure, there have been enormous benefits from capitalism, from this non-zero-sum nature that has developed. And it's not at all obvious. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, the alternatives are not good. Like, degrowth is not, it doesn't seem sensible. Like, it seems like it's going to cause a lot of problems, right?
Yeah,
it seems like
poverty.
I mean, it seems like it could accelerate geopolitical disasters even further. Sure, yeah. I mean, it just seems terrible and seems like against human nature. But the current path we're on is also, I mean, what it's done to the planet cannot be understated, right? We are currently undermining our own existence, and it's fairly urgent. And I mean, you talk about startup cities. I mean, those things take decades, right? To like, it takes time to develop the infrastructure. It takes time to understand the, you know, like all the various implications. And do we have that much time, you know? And so it's not all obvious that we have good options either way. But I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
You wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So just to say that I'm certainly not saying that we are in the optimal system or equilibrium or whatever. Sure. But what I am saying is that, you know, and I'm not saying that we released millions of years worth of carbon in a couple of centuries, right? Like these batteries, mm-hmm. like that have been charging for millions of years, we released it back out, you know, in a couple of centuries. But if that is a kind of a rung in the ladder toward more clean sources of growth, then I think it's fine, right? So if we transition to a nuclear age, supplemented by, let's say, solar, right? So if we have a crack fusion, as I say in the book, or, you know, find better ways to use the fusion reactor in the sky with the sun, then I think we're in a, you know, we're in a totally different situation where a lot of these problems disappear. I mean, actually, you know, I'm less concerned about the energy concerns because we can move quickly when we want to. With the rise of AI, right, which it just kind of just emerged as I was finishing off the book, which I do cover a little bit. We have now invested in restarting nuclear reactors and, you know, much like China, just like powering up anything we can to take this big bet that AI represents a paradigm shift in our ability to solve problems and innovate and discover new things. It's a big bet. Does it pay off? Is it correct? We don't know, right? Like at the moment, early stages, you know, MIT had a report that came out a couple of months ago. Only 5% of businesses have successfully implemented AI in a way that's actually been profitable. That means 95% of businesses have not, right? So it's unclear, but we're taking this big bet. And at least I think the amount of energy that we're releasing is a good thing. So I guess like of the paths that we see here, if I were to bring it a little bit more personally, the reason that I kind of also switched from engineering to working on the human side of things, you know, as I like to say these days, you know, the problem that Elon Musk couldn't solve, you know, the human element in all of this stuff, is because that to me was the ignored side of things. Like when I remember watching like Al Gore's documentary, when I watched it, I was like, is this guy right? Right? Is this Inconvenient Truth true? And I was like, I don't know, man. Like, are you just bitter because you lost the election and, you know, all of that kerfuffle happened? Like, what happened? So I went back and I read the IPCC reports and I read the Pentagon reports. And I was like, oh, damn. Like, because, you know, I read the IPCC reports and I was like, maybe you guys are still biased. So I went back to the Pentagon reports and I was like, yeah, this is a matter of national security. This is probably correct. We're going to fight over water. We're going to have mass migration. Why are we not talking about this? Like, why is no one preparing for this? And like, and then I'm looking at it and I'm like, wait, your solution is mitigation? Like, you think we're going to slow the economy to save the planet? That's your plan? And I'm like, this is nuts, right? So this is not going to happen. And we at least, I mean, if it does, amazing. I'll be very glad to be wrong, but we need a better solution. And to me, that solution is more on the upward, but redirecting where we put our efforts, right? So if we lived in a world of abundance, like clean abundance, we can choose to clean up the mess that we have created. We can choose, like, we're going to suffer a certain amount of irreversible biodiversity loss. That,
I mean,
it's done. It's gone.
I mean, what do you say to the pessimists that are, you know, that think that that's not possible? Like, clean growth is not possible. Like, nuclear energy is only going to get you so much. It's going to take care of, you know, maybe electricity, but then there's all these other issues of energy fungibility and, like, you know.
So we can get, I'm relying on the energy scientists and people should read, you know, their work directly, I think. But alongside, so one of the issues, are, you know, even with solar as well, leave aside nuclear, is that we need more electrification of the grid, right? So you know, when as we transition to fully electric, we get a whole bunch of efficiencies. With solar, you've got transmission issues, and some of it can be done on site, putting solar on, especially in a place like Australia or Texas or something. Like, by the way, you know, where are the green technologies being developed? It's not California, it's Texas, right? Texas is like the number one on solar and wind and all these other things, because they're just like gung ho on the energy, total energy in general, right? These do solve a lot of the problems. If we reserved fossil fuels for lubricating the wind turbines, not a huge fan of wind, but let's say they were reserved for that, and for let's say flight or something, you know, like space travel and flight, that'd be great, right? Because a lot of other things, and for medicines and for other uses that we have for crude oil, that would be great. Most other things, ships, transport of all kinds, your heating, your air conditioning, all of that stuff can be electrified, right? So there are clear, obvious paths that are not like crazy science fiction that lay in front of us. And I just think the pessimists are not realists about this. We can choose to live in that world. And it doesn't require us to upend the economic system. And I feel like some people just want to upend the economic system for things that have nothing to do with climate.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I've definitely consumed a lot of like pessimist content, you could say, in terms of like the limitations of resources. You know, I mean, you talk about, you know, if you're going to electrify everything, you need the batteries for it. Where are you getting the materials for the batteries? Do you have enough? For how many generations? Yeah. How good is recycling? What is what are the thermodynamic limits of like just recycling things?
I just think there's a poverty of imagination around a lot of this stuff, right? maybe we don't need to recycle a lot of stuff, because if it's not, you know, crude oil based, it could be biodegradable and we can just forget about it. We just think about the input, right? Like plastics that are formed out of, you know, bacteria or something like that, bacterial byproducts. Lithium is one means by which we can store electricity, but there may be others, right? Like hydrogen being the most obvious, right? Like if you've got solar and nuclear as in your mix, like, you know, nuclear is taking care of the base load. You've got solar whenever the sun is shining. And at times there's going to be excess. As long as you have access to water, you can produce hydrogen. You can produce as much of it as you want, right? And then there are ways to store that hydrogen. And hydrogen is abundant. It's 98% of the universe. Like, it's not like,
okay,
you know,
So let's say we do all that and we have all, more or less all the energy we need. But then, you know, I mean, you're familiar with Jevons paradox, and it's like, are we going to So we're going to use more energy.
Is better.
Right, but then more resource, but like the
there's nothing
resource
wrong with
extraction,
using more energy.
True. Well, wrong. What is it? How is it being, like, what are the implications of that?
There's nothing wrong
use,
with
right?
Yeah. Inherently, there's nothing wrong with using more energy, consuming more, and living a higher quality life. There is nothing inherently wrong with that. What is wrong with it is what is the cost of doing that on the planet in a variety of different ways. And so then we can get down to the nuts and bolts of the specifics of how are you mining, for example? What are you mining? What is the cost to what environments? And in all of these cases, we should not be ignoring trade-offs. Right? Like, there is a human cost and there's a, you know, there's an environmental cost and there's an animal cost or whatever. And there are serious trade-offs. Like, how many bats are worth, you know, a single, you know, quality year of human life? You know, how many fish are worth like, these are serious trade-offs that one could make on all of these things. And I'm just saying
But how do you propose under the current economic system that you're even giving two shits about those trade-offs? Right? Like,
I mean, in actual fact, we give too much in some cases towards that, right? And again, it depends on the country. In the UK, for example, I mean, I love this. In the UK's, I beat up on the UK a little too much, I think, but they do some crazy things. We haven't been able to build Sizewell C, the nuclear reactor, for a very long time, most recently because of environmental concerns, right? So there's the environmental concerns, then there's the back and forth around, like, it's challenged, and so you never get anything built. If listeners, please Google fish discos. right? Fish discos was the most recent thing. So what was the problem? The problem was that there were environmentalists who were concerned that the fish are going to get sucked into the intake for the water that's used for cooling the reactor. So how you got to stop the fish from being sucked in. Why does a mesh not work? I don't know. Maybe it gets clogged. I have no idea. But the solution, the actual solution that someone had actually proposed that had been tabled and accepted was sound, basically blasting sound for the 60 years that this nuclear reactor is going to go, the fish discos, so the fish don't come near the inlets, right? Great. We have a solution. Let's go build Sizewell C, except the porpoise people and the cetacean people came out and was like, that's going to interfere with the whales. Okay, so I think we're not making sensible decisions around a lot of this already, and it allows us to ignore the very serious environmental costs that we're in terms of polluting the ocean or cutting down forests and these other things. So we do this, and I think we just do it in a clumsy way. I think we can just do all of this far more efficiently.
Sorry, we do it in very specific circumstances, and yes, it is abused by environmentalists who are not looking at the larger picture or not being flexible enough, for sure. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, every example you cite, I'm going to agree with you, right? But like, if you just look at the totality of what's going on, it's hard to say that we are actually managing these trade-offs in any like remotely acceptable manner. Like the trajectory of like, yeah, I mean, just the amount of, I mean, just PFAS, plastics. What impact that has? I mean, yeah, we're digging up stuff from the ground. We're converting into like novel chemicals and substances that organic life has no way of like accounting for. And we're, some of us, I guess, are surprised that it's leading to problems. But we're going to keep what my concern is. Like under the current economic paradigm, we're going to continue to do that. And it's like,
so that's, this is where I disagree. So this is okay. Where that leap is where I disagree. Right. So it's not like, I agree. We're making some mistakes. And I think, in some cases we're running experiments in society where people did not consent. And we are not, we're not passive observers, right? We are active participants in the decisions about what happens. We're just often not paying enough attention to these. And my assumption is that people don't want to consume garbage. Like people don't want to consume things that are toxic to them. People don't want the air to be polluted with toxins from coal power plants or people don't want this stuff. And the trajectory that I do see is one where we have reduced a lot of that. We created new things, right? Like, what's that joke? Don't worry, you're not going to make the same mistakes that your parents did. You're going to make new mistakes. Right. Like that's like we've cleaned up a lot. There was a big hole in the ozone layer above, Australia. We transitioned off CFCs. Right. To help repair that hole.
That is like the most significant international success that we've had on like a commons issue for sure. Yeah.
Britain used to have coal plants in South London that were, under. During the war and later, that was just polluting it. London was a cesspit of people dying of respiratory disease and things. We turned them off. We found ways to, because people don't want to live like that. So, I think that the pressure is already.
I don't mean to cut you off, but like we've turned it off, but we've externalized, you said before, a lot of that into poorer countries. But it's like, and because we use more and more shit, it's like we gain efficiency. But we're. Yeah, and, yeah, and yes, and there's more, and we're gonna. I mean, I don't know, like fuck.
There's more.
Excuse my pessimism,
So I guess we are more efficient than we've ever been, right? So I mean, it's like, what exactly are people looking for, right? Everything is far more efficient than it was. We are using less to produce more. There's just more of us, and the demand for a higher quality of life is higher. And people look at that and go, you know what? We should do. We should like cut people's demand for a higher quality of life. Nobody is stopping anyone from going and living like the Hadza. Go for it. And I'm saying that is not a viable solution. So if you accept that that's not a viable solution, the next best thing is to consider each of these costs that we are imposing on society. And I'm saying people already don't want those costs, right? And if it's not in your backyard, the people in China don't want those costs. And if it's not in their backyard, the people in Bangladesh don't want those costs. Right. So there is a kind of demand for not having those costs, but there are actual trade-offs. Like people may be willing to live to 80, but have microplastics in their body if it means that they can also vacation you know, three times a year instead of once or zero or something like that. Like, people can make these kinds of trade-offs. But I don't see a world that's getting worse. I see a world that, for the most part, is getting better with some very specific problems that still need to be resolved, and some that I think will blow up the whole system. Like, if we lose our ability to govern one another and we lose our ability to cooperate at a sufficiently high scale, then all of this is over. Like, we're not going to talk about – forget international cooperation. We're not going to have national cooperation. That, to me, is the existential threat. It's not like what – It's not what the environmentalists are deeply concerned about. We've passed those thresholds. If anything, we need to be investing in climate engineering on how to, like, let's say, like, here's some scenarios. Like, I don't know, right? Again, talk to a climate scientist about this. If we return to Pleistocene level fluctuations, right, that we evolved in, like, where we have ice ages and warming, like, that is going to be bad. And we're going to have to find ways to soften that blow if the Earth re-enters a cycle that it was previously in. That, to me, is far worse than the PFAS or whatever else we're putting into the environment, which may or may not have some cost to human health, which may or may not have some cost down the line. You know, we can quantify it to some degree. There are more urgent existential problems that are connected to these environmental concerns. But I just think it's like the overpopulation concern that everyone had. I don't think it was ever a real concern. That was never going to be the solution. And if anything, it's created a new problem.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think there's debate about the carrying capacity of the planet and what is, you know, what.
Yeah, there is debate.
I'll just leave that part at that.
We agree. There's debate. Yeah.
But okay, so let's say that, you know, people agree on all the, like, you know, the environmental issues, and I'm not sure, like, people do agree, or, you know, stated versus real preferences. They don't care, right? Like, I mean, I go to Chipotle all the time. Chipotle is awesome. You're throwing away so much shit, you know, single use items. And it's like, who's giving that up? Who's, you know, who's bringing their own, like, bowl to Chipotle, you know, to get that filled?
So again, I just don't know, you know, in your specific example, I don't know how much that specific thing matters, right? Like, so people want to feel like they're doing something, you know, and a lot of these kinds of activities are just pointless. Like, they're genuinely pointless. Like, there's a case to be made. You know, Hannah Ritchie has a great book where she goes through some of the stats on this stuff, right? So often eating local is worse than eating, you know, things that are grown in Kenya and brought over to you, because the transport cost of foods is often cheaper in terms of its carbon footprint and energy cost and just general bad things for the planet, than growing things in a greenhouse, right? Plastic bags, even if we, you know, they're so thin, they're so easy to produce, burying those plastic bags for the next, you know, 100,000 years or whatever you might, however you might dispose of it, may actually be better than the reusable bags that we end up using, right? Plastic straws, like, the, you know, like, God, we're now ingesting God knows what out of these paper straws for reasons that were just pointless. You know, people still have this idea, we got to turn off the light. I'm just saying, look, a lot of these activities are just not a concern. They're just not. Like, I know they're on people's minds, but they're not.
No, that's fair. That's fair. My point wasn't to go down that rabbit hole. I was using it as an example to talk about, let's say people agree in general about certain environmental things. Then the bigger question is,
but what,
like,
are those
how
things?
Do we,
like,
I'm saying, like, we agree that we want cleaner air, et cetera.
So let's talk about those things.
Like, okay.
Yeah, so let's talk about those things. So we want to be able to consume energy, but to do that, we re-release a bunch of carbon. And that is because a lot of our energy comes out of coal or oil or natural gas, but it doesn't have to. And if you were consuming energy that came out of nuclear or solar, all of that goes away. And you can consume as much energy as you want, and you can do whatever you want with it, and it's not a problem anymore, because it's not, you know, it's not affecting the climate anymore. It's not polluting the air, right? You might be concerned that we are creating a landfill problem. I don't know how much of a concern the landfill problem is. Is it leaking into the water? Does it have permit? Maybe we can just bury it in a hole that hasn't moved for a million years and forget all about it, because how much of it is actually being produced? Maybe there are ways to recycle some of it, but we don't have to recycle all of it. I'm just saying that, like, you know, like, people, like, where are people getting their stats from? Where are people getting their ideas from? And that is part of the whole cultural software that we're talking about, right? It's the people want to feel like they're doing something, they're concerned about these things, but how much of a, like, a few things might explain like 90% of the problem. And, you know, and that's why I think, you know, was it Bill Gates recently or something? He said, you know, I'm no longer worried about the climate or something, you know, like people are less concerned than they once were. Right. But there's a lag. I mean, I
don't know how much of that is based on science. I mean, the science that I read, which, again, full disclosure, is probably, you know, a bit biased in a certain direction. But like, I mean, you can kind of
more carbon almost in the environment creates longer growing cycles in Canada. And is also just good for plants, right? Like there are these kind of trade-offs along all of these. One of the other inconvenient truths is that the world is worse off, but some places will be better off than they were before.
Some places will be better off, but if the migration and all the other, you know, famine and all that stuff happen, I mean, that seems like pretty bad. I agree.
And then there's different ways to deal with that. One is to try to stem the cause of, which I think is too late. It's all over. The other way is to deal with it directly. What are you going to do when 1 million Bangladeshis are underwater and flooding into India, then into Pakistan, the Middle East, and in Europe? Right? What's the plan? That is the bigger concern. It's just no longer like, are we going to reduce? Like, there's no lever available to us to reduce. Well,
okay, and so this is what I was trying to get at is fundamentally, you know, we agree that that's a problem. That's something we avoid among a host of other issues. It seems like fundamentally these are coordination problems that we have to solve. And I don't know how we do it. I mean, you proposed some things in terms of governance, DAOs, these decentralized. Can you elaborate on that for people who aren't aware of it?
So I mean, this was me kind of saying, so we have inherited systems, right, of governance that were designed for a very different world, right? The Electoral College is because you had to have people riding on horseback to, like, say what the people wanted, and you had these electors in place. You know, it's easier to make decisions when you're highly culturally homogenous, because otherwise you're fighting for these, you know. So if everyone agrees that socialized healthcare is the way forward, you just pick the best person who can implement what everyone agrees is the plan. If you're fighting over that, you don't pick the best person, you pick your person, because your person is going to take the country in a very different direction. So it's just not clear to me that democracy, or the systems of government and democracy that we currently have, are well suited to larger, way larger, and way more diverse populations than we had previously. And, you know, and this problem is exacerbated because our ability to coordinate at a sufficiently large scale on smaller concerns has grown. So a lot of what we see today in the world with these kind of really minority concerns becoming a big thing for everyone is that the internet and social media have created new tribes, right? So, you know, I have a couple of, like, funny examples of it. It's like, you know, do you enjoy, like, taking bread and stapling it to a tree and then take photos of it for everyone on the internet? Is that your thing, Levon?
No. I mean,
no, but 30,000 people on Reddit do it all the time.
Right.
You know, it's like, what about carrying sand in your pockets? Is that a thing? Like, do you carry sand in your pocket because you might use it? No? Well, there's like 300,000 people on Reddit who are, like, you know, big into this. There are these subcommunities, right? So, you know, whatever, like, obscure medical concern that you have, the tales of the human distribution are spreading. All of those things. Like, you used to, I cite, like, the TV show Little Britain. We've got this character, you know, he says, I'm the only gay in the village. Once upon a time, if you were like a member of the LGBT community, you were the only person, maybe a handful, right? And it was hard to find the other people that you could have some kind of community. Now, through the internet, you can connect up and, you know, in all these ways. So for good and bad, you get these ways of creating new tribes, coordinating, collaborating, and then competing with one another. It's not clear that democracy works under those systems. And so what I propose is, like, now that we have these new technologies, are there other ways to govern ourselves? Like, are there ways to reduce, to shrink the size of government, make it responsible for fewer things, and devolve some of these things? It doesn't even, like, some things are going to be geographic, right? Like, I can't be part of the firefighters union that is spread across the globe, because if my house burns down, I, you know, the fact that I belong to the group in Estonia is not going to help me. So that has to be local. But in other cases, things could be highly globalized, right? Maybe access to healthcare could be globalized. taxation of some kind can be globalized. There's different ways of creating this. So these, you know, smart contracts or DAOs are ways to recapture some of what was previously handled by courts or governments or these other ways of cooperating with one another in a algorithmically mediated manner. But we just don't have the infrastructure for it, right? So if you imagine like currencies are currently based on like you pay with the US dollar or something. If you had a variety of these different currencies and they were tied to things that you cared about, like your currency, by virtue of you transacting in it, pays certain taxes, like for every transaction or however that was set up, that then gave you access to education or gave you access to internet or gave you access to electricity or gave you access to whatever it might be, you can transact more in that. And then you can have this effectively what we call cultural group selection competing in these different polities, which can then, you know, emerge a secret, and you will then belong to multiple overlapping and embedded systems. But you can't have people thinking about that. You have to have the infrastructure to allow for that to take place. But that's so far away, right? In the here and now, you can get some version of that by giving people more power at a kind of lower scale, if you like allowing the creation of new cities. Right. We want more democratic experiments. We want more governance experiments. This is one of the few spheres that we do not sufficiently experiment in to discover new ways of cooperating with one another. Right. There are ways, you know, again, sorry, I'm just in Australia, so I'm thinking about it. But Australia is really good, actually, at innovating on governance. So they, you know, they deliberately have like an electoral science system, basically, where voting is compulsory, first off. You know, people get a day off. It's a kind of a national celebration. Everyone goes to the polls. There's often like free democracy sausages, as they call them, sausage sizzles. And because it's, you know, because it's compulsory, it's also a preferential voting system. So it used to be that you can vote for any of your minority concerns. In the United States, it falls on two parties. If you want to change the United States, you have two choices: change the Democrats or change the Republicans. That's the only way to do it. You know, that's why I said, you know, the difference between China and the United States is one party. And I don't mean China has one party. I mean, America has one more, you know, like those. The only way to change China is through the CCP. The only way to change America is one of the two parties. In Australia, you can vote for like the fishing and shooting party because you're really into fishing and shooting rights. You can vote for the free speech party. You can vote for any party you want because they're never going to get into power, but they represent your concern. And then what they do is if they don't get sufficient votes, they pass those votes on to the next closest policy aligned party, and they pass it on to the next one. And so you can never have a situation where you are ruled by a plurality. So in Canada, worse still, you've got like three viable parties, which means that you could have the Liberal vote split across, let's say 30-30, which does happen, and the Conservatives get 40% of the vote. And despite the fact that 60% of the country do not want them, the Conservatives are now in power. Terrible system. But my point is that we don't innovate on this at all. And there are ways to innovate on it at a kind of localized scale. Justice Brandeis referred to the United States, each of the states, as a laboratory for democracy. And that's what it's meant to be. Like every state and every county and every is meant to be a laboratory.
But how do you push governments, local, state, whatever? Like, how do you push them to do that? Like
they learn from. Well,
let me give you an example. I mean, here, so in Missouri. And there was actually a proposition to ban even bringing up ranked choice voting as like a thing. I mean, that's where we're at, right? Yeah. So how do you, I mean, where do you even start?
Yeah. So, but I mean, to me, that's not a problem. Like that's like, again, we don't impose things on one another, right? So you think ranked choice voting is a good way forward. I agree with you. Our job is to convince the rest of the population that it's a good thing, right? That's how democracy works. Like we don't, you know, I don't get to be like, it's obviously true, idiots. Like, let's do it. I have to, that's how it works. And so even if we can't do it, so let's take my earlier example. California, 19th century law, bans non-compete agreements. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? In advance, who the hell knows? Like, you know, like IP has to be protected for companies, surely, right? Like, I build something. I don't want you to be able to steal that idea by stealing my employees. Surely that's a good thing. Turns out it's not such a good thing, at least not for like the rate of innovation that the California allowed. So what happened? Eventually, other states also banned non-compete agreements by copying what California was doing. And then as of, I think it was April 2024, it became federal law. The non-compete agreements were banned across the board, right? That's how, you know, the system that I propose in the book, this kind of a system where we're evolving institutions rather than designing them would work. right? So Missouri is trying to like do this ranked choice. Good for you, Missouri. Good luck with that. Terrible idea. Your state's going to suffer while, you know, maybe Michigan's going to try something different, right? And Missouri looks, oh, it's like, hang on. Maybe there is something there, you know?
Then you would say the fundamental layer of change is at a cultural level, right? If you don't have the levers of power, then all you've got is, you know, I guess doing the groundwork to try to.
That's right. And this is also what I meant, right? When I said earlier that democracy is not free and fair elections. That's like, you know, that's the measure. It's one means by which we achieve democracy. It's one measure of democracy, if you like. It's the same way that GDP is not growth. It's just one measure of it or something like that. It is the degree to which the will of the people is expressed through the decisions of government. And there's many ways the democracy is stymied, right? There's many ways that this happens. One is that you don't have free and fair elections. People never get a choice. You don't have accurate information about the world. That's also a problem. The people in power are highly corrupt, and they're just never, you know, special interests have control over what decisions are being made. It's impossible to rise up through the ranks because there's some kind of block or, you know, in the way. So an average person can never become president or prime minister or whatever the case may be. There's many different ways where democracy is failing. And I think if we see it as the mismatch between the will of the people. And again, you know, I don't want to gloss over issues of minority rights and, you know, what is it? Democracy is three wolves and a sheep deciding what to have for dinner. Like, you know, there's ways of managing that. That's why we don't live in a direct democracy. We live in a republic. There's ways of managing this. Nonetheless, fundamentally, it is for the people, by the people. It's the will of the people.
Yeah. And no, yeah, that culture makes is the sense. Way to change that. Yeah. And speaking of, okay, so. Just one final point on this, on changing culture. I mean, your book didn't mention a whole lot on like the media and kind of like trying to market some of these ideas. I mean, obviously like podcasting's become just a huge thing. Not this podcast per se, but you know, in general.
I hope that's
what I mean. not yet, but I mean, what do you have to say about that landscape and how it can be utilized to make some positive change?
Yeah, I mean, I do go on and on about the importance of free speech, right? Like, free speech is it's the connective tissue of the collective brain. Like, if we don't know what we think, like, if I don't know what you think and you don't know what I think, that's bad. Even if what you think sucks and what I think sucks, it's just a terrible thing. We need to know in order to make good and accurate decisions. So free speech is absolutely essential. There's a marketplace of ideas, but the problem is that there are distortions in that marketplace, and they come from a variety of means. Typically and traditionally and historically, the distortion in the marketplace of ideas is that the most powerful, the wealthiest, those in government suppress speech they do not like through blasphemy laws, through, you know, banning, insulting the government. And so this is still true, right? And again, we have the rise of blasphemy laws because, you know, Islam primarily in the EU. We have, you know, it's still illegal to make fun of people in parliament in the UK. Not my king, people were arrested during the coronation. The US's protection of free speech, backed by, you know, the First and Second Amendment are very unique historically. And I think our best bet at like figuring things out. And I think in part, that's why America has been such a cultural innovator. Because you the craziest ideas
not get always in good ways, to be fair. There's good and bad a lot is, of you know, shitty export. Yeah, but
yeah. But what I mean is like, you know, like everything from like the environmental movement to sexual revolution to you know, even just the rights of free reason. Like that has happened because like, you know, what's the quote? God, I should look it up. But you know, like basically like you have to leave room for unconventional ideas, even ones that you hate, in order to decide what should be convention in the future. If like it's really hubris to think that our current moral systems and our current ways of viewing things, like this is the end state, like we've gotten it right. Every generation has a right to kind of question and figure that stuff out. And that means like allowing the craziest, worst ideas to, and evolution is a messy system, right? You get bad mutations. In fact, most mutations are deleterious, but that's how the system, that's how we figure stuff out. We try new things and it's like, oh, that didn't work. Maybe we reverse course. We do something a bit different. And you cannot innovate without making mistakes. It just doesn't, like, if you already knew what the right thing to do was, you'd have done it. You know, like the reason we have to have this kind of evolutionary landscape where people are trying different things is because we don't know what the right way forward is. So free speech is one way to do that. The other thing with media, of course, is that it's distorted in a variety of ways. But because free speech is often distorted by those in power, you know, those who are kind of the gatekeepers of what books get published, what papers get published, you know, what gets into the New York Times, what, you know, the fact that we have this new media that is emergent on places like Substack and X and LinkedIn or whatever, that's a good thing because it potentially challenges, it's a place where new ideas can be voted on. Now, there's new threats to that, obviously, because the algorithms are obscure in some ways, or, you know, they're at least, obscure is the wrong word, they are opaque, right? And so we don't know what's getting bubbled up, which then it creates a new vector for manipulating the population. By manipulating the, you know, the perceived consensus of ideas because bots are voting things up or whatever. So I think, you know, in order to make good decisions or to say anything in terms of the media, it is that we want to know what other people think. And we want a way to amplify what other people think in a kind of prestige plus conformity plus, you know, new idea driven way where everyone's vote is counted in some manner. It's precisely those distortions to what I just described that makes capitalism or the excesses of capitalism come about when you have those distortions, when you have those in control of, you know, our energy budget or our goods and resources that did not earn it. It was unearned intergenerational transfers or something like that. It is precisely when you have the government or incredibly powerful players controlling the thoughts, the cultural software that is being written in people's heads, that you have these distortions that harm our ability to make good decisions into the future. And you end up with people with wacky ideas that are not well matched to their own interests and the interests of us all.
So it was us all along. It wasn't capitalism. Capitalism is good, but humans.
There's a version of capitalism. You know, maybe I'm defending it too strongly, but you know, there's a version of.
Yeah.
I'm doing it in part because you're going after it, but like, yeah. There's a version of. There's a version of cultural evolution that manifests through our institutions that is good.
But it's almost fair to say there's really no system that's going to work. If you don't have the cultural backbone in place, right?
Yeah,
I think you could envision some sort of economic system with some of the merits of capitalism. I mean, you want competition, like some level of competition, right? Like there's various elements that you do want. But yeah, it's just without the cultural backbone, it's just like it almost seems like it's impossible to really design
a
perfect system, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, democracy is the worst system, but it's the best, you know, it's the best of these worst systems, right? But equally, our institutions are built on invisible cultural pillars. Like, it actually doesn't matter what the Constitution says if the culture says we can ignore it. Like, if you don't have rule of law, right? If you don't have this idea that we are ruled by principles and not by people, then it doesn't matter what's on the paper. Like, the paper doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's exactly what Trump's logic has been thus far. It's, yeah.
Not making any political commentary.
You're exactly right. I mean, you.
So yeah, if you don't have. And you need, you know, and ultimately, you know, as you know, earlier I said, ultimately at the bottom, it's all physics. And that expands out to the physics of interpersonal relations, which is violence, right? We often live in a world of computers and words, and we forget that actually what backs all of that up is the threat of violence. Mm-hmm. And you see that, you know, when Ukraine gets invaded, for example, right? Like, ultimately, your paper's not worth anything. Might is right at some level, and the only way to enforce your piece of paper is with the sword.
Yeah, and we haven't even started talking about free will, so this or the lack thereof. I don't know. This has been a phenomenal conversation, just many different directions. I really appreciate you coming on. I think obviously, you know, we have some disagreements, but I think we actually agree quite a bit. I mean, I really enjoyed your book. I'm really happy that you're trying things out. Like the idea of startup cities, the idea of like just trying to see what could work. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer, right? It seems like, well, why aren't we experimenting? Like, like this is, yeah, we're not, this is not the final form of governments and institutions and all, like we should be experimenting. So I completely agree with your approach. I don't know how much time we have in terms of some of these environmental issues. I think I'm obviously more pessimistic about it than you are. But if we have the time, then I mean, I don't think we do. Seems like we're.
I don't think we do. I think we move. I don't think we do. I mean, I want to make that clear. I wasn't saying that we have the time to do this.
Sure.
I'm saying that we're about to hit like shit's getting harder, and that just means we have to move faster in the ways that we do things. But that also creates the correct selection pressure, right? The problem is that like what gets selected under those conditions could be a world of. I mean, I talk about this in the. I think it's in the startup part two, which I kind of lay out these two different worlds. And one of them is the return to a Malthusian reality where we no longer cooperate. Like it, just the ideals of an earlier age just seem bizarre. Like who could have thought that we could ever have ever worked together, even at the scale of a country, when we're so torn apart by, you know, the color of our skin and the religions that we believe in and so on.
And I think that's a key takeaway from this conversation is, we just given the circumstances, right? Like we can't go back to a zero sum game, right?
No, we could.
So like we should. I mean, if we did, it's going to be
It'd be terrible.
Essentially, guaranteed collapse. Yeah. Now we might be heading for collapse regardless, but it seems like perhaps innovation is the only thing that we can do at this point. We're just kind of locked in, given the size of the population, given the just inertia of the economic system and everything else. It seems like, I mean, we don't maybe necessarily have great options, but it might be the only option that we have at this point. And if certainly, you know, it was easier back in the day when you knew everyone, when we had small scale tribes, where we didn't we had an abundance of resources, but times are different, and it's not at all obvious what the, you know, as you said in this conversation, like the alternatives. What are the alternatives? So, much food for thought. If you're working on anything, feel free to share that. I think
Zanzibar. Well, no, I mean just to say that, you know, so the vehicle so a few things. So one is obviously read the book, but the vehicle that we've just. I will officially launch it early next year is the Center for Human Progress, which is based in London and New York, two separate entities, but working together. We have a clear pathway to policy through the Global Solutions Initiative in Europe. So Dennis Snower, who's the president of the Global Solutions Initiative, is one of the trustees on the UK side, and through the United Nations Development Program in the US as a kind of pathway to poverty. You'll see recently I did some work on AI in education and AI in human development. So we kind of have an engine that, you know, I'm still an engineer at heart. I like building minimal viable products. I like seeing things taken to scale. And what we're looking for, as I said, are these kind of Archimedes levers and with a clear pipeline between like the science that is done and what we could do with it rather than, you know, as an academic, I'm tired of being in the comments section. Like you're kind of just saying things about the world. I would rather just go do it. Even if it fails, I'd rather go try. And I think, you know, we're always looking for like-minded people, and of course funders, but also just people who are, you know, who take this stuff seriously, who are already doing this and just need to be kind of connected up, who think, hey, the world, they're not ideological about it. They are kind of data and science driven. They want to see a better world, and they're not driven by the typical concerns around money and prestige and so on.
That is awesome, man. Again, really, really happy that you are actually doing things in the world. So
good to chat, Lamont.
Yeah, thanks.